It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, managing to get through that barred door each week, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, good. You know, once you learn how to disable the security system in the radio station, it becomes really, really a pretty simple matter.
Once you know how to run the gauntlet of big, beefy guys right inside the door.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're sort of the last line of defense, and frankly, you're not much of an obstacle at all.
Exactly. People say I am a pushover. So, how'd y'all do on your voting picks this last week?
In terms of who we thought would win or who we wanted to win?
Well, let's do with who you thought it'd win.
I don't know. How about you, Maria?
Okay. Well, I think most of the people that I thought would get votes actually did get votes, and so there weren't too many surprises. I was very happily surprised by the school district races in particular.
Yeah, I was too. I was particularly Darlene Flynn and especially Breida Butler-Wall handily beat the incumbents in their races, and that was wonderful. Both of them are wonderful, wonderful candidates. Of course, they've both been on this program, and all of the progressive challengers in the school board races. Sally Soriano also did quite well. She'll be in the general election, and then Irene Flynn in West Seattle.
Yeah, Sally has a shot, and I'm very happy to see that.
I am too. And particularly, and of course we'll get back to this, having her get into the general election the same week that the WTO collapsed was just sort of sweet, you know?
I think she had something to do with that. I think she arranged that somehow. Just a, you know, publicity stunt.
Yeah, it could well be. But yeah, there were a number of other interesting things out of the election also. I think in general, of course, we saw finally with the recount that Cynthia Sullen, after 20 years, is out on the county council.
That was pretty close, though.
It was very close, but I don't think anybody expected Bob Ferguson to do that well. They expected him to run an aggressive campaign, but I think in the polling that had been done, he had been in the 40 to 45% range. I think all of the challengers to incumbents probably did at least 5 to 10 percentage points better than anybody expected them to. And we saw that with all the city council incumbents also, where there was just a lot of voter anger at all of them. The exception to that, I thought, it's also always hard to tell because of how mainstream media and particularly the daily papers and the Seattle Times in town have been after Judy Nicastro's butt for years now. But reading them, you would think that Nicastro was going to finish fourth in the field, and of course she didn't get as much of a vote as many of the other incumbents, but she had a much crowded field also, and she did finish on top in that field. So she didn't do as badly as I thought she might. But all of the other incumbents, Compton got under 40%, and hopefully he'll be going. That's a hard one because he's going to be facing John Manning, and what do you do with John Manning? So. Mm-hmm.
We've got like two very dismal races coming up in the city council positions for the November elections. The Margaret Pageler against Tom Rasmussen and Jim Compton and John Manning. Those are going to be really hard ones to decide. Do I just skip that vote or who do I vote for in those races?
Yeah, and any progressive challenger that wants to run a spirited write-in campaign, now might be the time to jump feet first into it for those two.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and we also had the monorail initiative, or not initiative, but the monorail, the two positions there.
Yes, we did, and those were interesting races too. Cindy Laws was the leader. She was the person who got all the endorsements for position 8, and she swept the field. And then for position 9, it was split out pretty well, pretty evenly, except for Cleve Stockmeyer, who took that one pretty handily, but all his other challengers were pretty evenly split.
And the other, Stockmeyer is not bad, although his position as a critic is belayed a little bit because he was an insider in the monorail project early on, so he has sort of that monorail cult ambiance to him just a tad bit.
And he also got all the endorsements.
Yes,
from
and
the
he
local
also got a number
so
of
forth.
Endorsements. But Brett McMillan, who has been just a wonderful citizen activist on that, did not make it through, which was kind of a shame.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping Brent will run for city council in another couple of years.
Yeah, another person I'd like to see run again is Crystal Wood. I think that she has grown a lot in this in her last couple of campaigns, and this one she showed a lot of maturity and a lot more focus on the issues than in prior ones. And I'd like to see her run again in a race where she's not challenging someone quite as hard to unseat as Heidi Wills.
She bumped ahead a little bit of Bob Hegeman.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then finally, the initiatives. Both one went passed, and the other one crashed and burned.
Yes, the marijuana initiative passed, and the espresso tax one crashed and burned.
Yep. I have to say, as much as I am often sort of disparaging of the Seattle Times, whoever is their headline writer there deserves a big fat bonus for their Wednesday morning headline about espresso tax creamed. I thought that was prime.
Now, what I want to see, now that the espresso tax vote has gone down, that the espresso tax initiative hasn't passed, what I want to see is some of these newspapers like the Seattle Times and the PI who have come out with their opinions that you should vote no on the espresso tax because what Washington State really needs is a fairer tax system. I want to see these newspapers start to cover initiatives and efforts to actually change Washington State's tax structure for a more progressive one. It would be really nice if these two newspapers actually decided, well, gosh, since we took that stand, maybe we should be looking a little bit more at people's efforts to make a difference in changing our very unfair tax structure. And I'd like to see them also cover efforts by groups who are trying to get a bit more money for things like, you know, early childhood education, child care, health care for poor and indigent.
Yeah, that's where I thought you were going with it originally, is I would like to see them hold the feet to the fire of politicians who aren't funding these sorts of issues. They're saying, the whole rap on this, well, this is a worthy goal, this is something worth funding, this is the wrong way to do it. Well, then hold the feet to the fire of the politicians who aren't finding the right ways to do it.
Yeah, and as we know, people in the state of Washington, if we're going to change our tax structure and if we're really going to change where the money goes, it's going to have to come to a vote of the general electorate here in Washington. And as we know, that can't happen, and people can't really be educated on the issues if our two main newspapers aren't on board to really try and help people understand what's going on and cover the issue a little bit.
Yeah, as opposed to, you know, relentlessly campaigning for repeal of the death tax, for one random example.
Well, speaking of crashing and burning, the WTO didn't do so well this last week.
No, it did not. And for that, I think many listeners who might have been out on the streets and in Seattle 4 years ago should give themselves at least somewhat of a pat on the back. I think there's a pretty direct line between what happened here in Seattle 4 years ago and what happened in Cancun this past week.
Yeah, and people who are listening to the prior program probably heard a pretty good take on why and what the mechanism was and what the fallout will be now that the talks in Cancun collapsed. But I just want to emphasize that they really collapsed over the issue of opening up investment and trade barriers in developing nations. So it really was an issue that Japan and Europe and the United States were pushing for developing nations to let down all trade barriers and let down all barriers to foreign investment into their countries. That's the issue that forced these nations to walk out. And as the person that they were interviewing on Counterspin said, that really is the one issue that would have the most impact on the economy of developing nations. And that was when the delegates from Kenya and Uganda and Botswana and some of the other nations that were part of this 23-nation group that got together and decided they were going to form a bloc against the U.S. and Europe on some of these issues. That's when those guys got up and said, "We can't deal with you anymore."
Yeah, and not just the small African nations, but some of the largest economies in the South as well. Brazil, China was in there.
Argentina,
which ironically the United States pushed very hard for the inclusion of China in WTO, and this was their first ministerial. India was part of that. they were all aligned against. And of course, you know, you had the U.S. and the European Union and Japan saying, well, this is all for the benefit of the poor developing South. And it was nothing of the kind. Even though you had, I mean, the local daily papers were playing that up also. It was, well, you know, to the great disappointment of Washington's farmers and of the developing economies of the South. And, you know, it was nothing of the kind. The South and the governments in the South are, by and large, controlled by the economic elites in many of those countries. They would not be doing this unless, number one, it was catastrophic for the economies of those countries, and number two, unless the public in those countries, which are in many ways democracies much more to the extent than the United States is anymore, were strongly opposed to this sort of agenda. And they are. And that sort of public pressure, and again, the global justice and fair trade movement, which reared itself in the North here in Seattle 4 years ago, had a lot to do over the past 15 years with developing the groundswell that brought it to this. And I also want to say, in addition to that, that the United States has been hedging its bets against this kind of development for really since Seattle. And one of the strategies for that has been developing these multilateral regional agreements, such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Miami in November is the next summit of ministers and heads of state. They'll be negotiating for the FTAA, and that then becomes the next battleground for these issues.
Right. And a slightly more sophisticated analysis, and I just say this, slightly more sophisticated analysis, is what you'll find in the business press talking about the collapse of WTO talks and how now nations will move to bilateral trade agreements and these regional multilateral agreements that are similar to NAFTA and a trade bloc that's forming now in Asia with China and Japan and some of their neighbors, and the European Union, for example, and as in its own little trade grouping, economic grouping now, that those are actually a step backwards from the WTO. Really what they're talking about is, you know, one group of apples versus another group of apples versus another group of apples. You know, you're basically looking at the same thing just on different levels. In bilateral agreements, the U.S. or European Union always holds most of the cards. It's the same in the WTO. It's the same in regional trade blocs. It's the same regardless of where you go. So really the fight continues, whether it's the WTO, whether it's these regional trade agreements that are and blocs that are forming, or whether it's bilateral trade talks. Just wanted to point that out.
Yep.
So you're saying the U.S. is card sharks?
We are.
Basically, yep.
Uh-huh. Well, let's move along. Look at this week in Iraq, and we're gonna be starting our testing of potential music for this week in Iraq.
Okay,
and, you know,
so do we have like this online polling that we can do for this, or
we have
a 1-900 number
our
people can call?
Sophisticated computer systems. We actually will. We are tied into everyone's radio to see whether they turn it off, whether they throw something at it, or whatever. We're looking at, for a couple weeks here, looking at former TV show music. I know it sounds horrible, but here we go. This Week in Iraq. It is, of course, the theme song from Sesame Street.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Maria, tell us.
I think it's got some potential.
It's got some potential. I don't know. I think Gilligan's Island might be better.
I don't know. Maybe McHale's Navy. I mean, there's many possibilities.
There's many.
All right. So.
I Dream of Jeannie.
So, This Week in Iraq, I'm going to start out by talking about Senator Edward Kennedy, who gave an interview to the Associated Press this week, saying that the Bush administration has failed to account for nearly half of the $4 billion per month of U.S. taxpayer money that's being spent on the Iraqi war. That's currently being spent on the Iraqi war. He cited a recent report by the Congressional Budget Office that shows that $1.5 billion is simply disappearing every month with no explanation from the Bush administration or the Pentagon. Senator Kennedy speculated that the money's being used to bribe foreign governments to send troops to Iraq. Currently, the governments that are being pressured include Turkey, Pakistan, and South Korea. Now, some of that money could be going elsewhere. And I just want to talk about a couple of places where I think it might be going. The LA Times reported this week that State Department officials are warning that the Mujahideen Khalq is still operating in Iraq. Now, people who have been paying attention to Iraq know who the Mujahideen Khalq is. They're a group that was funded by Saddam Hussein that ran cross-border raids into Iran during his rule. The MK, as I'll call them, are listed on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. However, the Pentagon is now supposedly funding the Mujahideen Khalq and helping them run their cross-border raids, even though they're supposed to be keeping its members in detention.
Yeah, they came to some sort of an agreement with the MK a while back, about two or three months ago.
They came to an agreement shortly after the war started, the recent war started. They made the MK give up some of their heavy weapons, but allowed them to keep all of their light weapons. And supposedly, they're supposed to be keeping the MK, an eye on the MK and keeping them in their confined in their camps. But, however, a State Department official told the LA Times that there was, quote, what could almost be described as a rogue operation being run out of the Pentagon to keep the organization alive and viable anti-Iranian group. Now, Colin Powell supposedly has also recently written a letter in protest to Donald Rumsfeld about this very situation. And I just want to point out that I think that's probably where some of these disappearing $1.5 billion a month might be going. Now, in the meantime, the members of the Iraqi Governing Council that was appointed by Paul Bremer, our U.S. Viceroy over in Iraq, are complaining that there's not enough money for the cabinet ministers to set up their departments and even to set up offices and run the new Iraqi government. Now, these new cabinet ministers have also complained to Colin Powell, as have many of the council members, that the leaders of the five main exile groups that the CIA, the U.S. Pentagon, and the State Department had worked with prior to the war and during the war and now after to set up the governing council, that these five main exile groups have seized all the power for themselves and have named their cronies to the most powerful cabinet posts. In addition, the new interior minister, who's also a member of one of these five exile groups, announced a plan to form an Iraqi militia composed of, can you guess, members of the militias that guard and protect the leaders of these five main exile groups. So this is probably where some of the rest of that $1.5 billion is going. But it also raises the issue of warlordism in Iraq when you have five separate groups who have set up their own private militias and then want to deploy these guys as troops to replace U.S. troops in Iraqi cities, as they have proposed. Then you have problems of how are these groups going to work together, who actually controls them and gives them their orders, and will infighting ensue as it has in Afghanistan?
Well, I wanted to raise that because, I mean, you've had this preposterous situation in Afghanistan for the last 2 years where not only has the central puppet Karzai government barely had any influence or control outside Kabul, and the rest of the country has been carved up among warlords, but you've had the CIA for the last 2 years literally running around the country with suitcases and wheelbarrows full of cash trying to pay off all these different factions so as to keep them nominally more or less under control and then not from ripping off too many people, holding up too many aid agencies at gunpoint, and at least passing along some of the profits from the poppy harvest probably to the CIA itself. And you know, you've almost got a very similar situation setting itself up now in Iraq.
And it's
ridiculous.
Reporters, I've seen news stories from reporters who are saying that the U.S. is paying tribal groups
yes.
to guard some towns and cities and even to run checkpoints on some roads, that in some areas of Iraq, especially in the west part of Iraq towards the Jordanian border, that some of these tribal groups actually steal cars and then you have to go and pay to get your car back. But these are also the same groups that the U.S. government is paying with U.S. taxpayer money in order to so-called police that area.
It's turning out to be protection rackets in many cases. And then, of course, these are many of the same people that the United States is having to turn around and pay whenever, you know, we shoot somebody in the village, and you wind up paying the relatives, you wind up paying the tribal chief, you wind up paying the village chief, you wind up paying all the policemen in town. And I mean, it's just, you know, if you're going to wind up passing out money willy-nilly to people, you know, on the street, why don't we do that in this country? But and then, you know, people in the the rest of the Muslim world look at this and see, well, this is bringing democracy to the Middle East. This looks a lot more like,
The people of Iraq, this is
like tyranny than anything else.
Yeah, for the people of Iraq, this is an enormous step backwards, because immediately after the war, when the U.S. announced, when Paul Bremer came into the country and he said, I'm going to disband the Iraqi army and replace it with tribal groups, people in Iraq were just, I mean, particularly the educated people who wanted to see Iraq move towards a democratic system after decades of repression, said, this is insane. We're going to be moving towards the Afghanistan model. And they really had a point. And, of course, that is where it is going.
Yeah, you really get the sense, and we saw that also this week in the last couple of weeks with the preposterousness of the Bush administration, you know, and some of the neocons like Bolton trotting out their various assertions of Iran and Syria having weapons of mass destruction. Like, they've got this very carefully worked out script that has absolutely nothing to do with reality. And anything can happen in the real world and is happening, and it doesn't affect their script. They're just not paying attention to what's actually happening on the ground. It's very, very frightening, because there's real lives that are being lost as a result, including the lives of American soldiers, but including an awful lot more lives of other people whose bodies we're not being allowed to see.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that the difference between bad actors and good actors, is bad actors can't really ad lib? They have to follow the script.
Well, and I think the U.S. public is actually catching on a little bit, because an ABC Washington Post poll showed that 61% of Americans oppose giving the Bush administration that $87 billion that they're going to Congress and asking for the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. 85% of Americans said that they were concerned that the U.S. is getting bogged down in Iraq. And that's up from 75% just 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I don't think Americans are being fooled by the Bush administration script anymore.
Hmm.
And that's a very positive development.
Yeah. Well, they'll just bring in new script writers. All right. Well, moving along. Anything else on Iraq there?
No, we'll just move on.
Okay. They talked a little bit about it at the top of the hour with Counterspin, but there's been a lot of brouhaha over Wesley Clark throwing his hat or helmet into the race.
Yeah, there has been, and it's been very interesting. I would suggest that for people who are enamored of Wesley Clark as an anti-war candidate, and, you know, regardless of the different things that he has or has not said about the military strategies in Iraq this time around, or whether it was wise to go in without U.S. support and so forth, the man has a track record, not to put too fine a point on it, as a war criminal. And I say this as somebody without a particular strong leaning one way or another toward Democratic candidates. I'm, in fact, moderating a panel Monday night at a church in Bellevue between Dean supporters and Kucinich supporters, and that ought to be a hoot. Wesley Clark, among many other things, was the head of the U.S. Southern Command, heavily involved in U.S. operations in Panama, involved in the support of the military coup and junta in Haiti in the early 90s, and the detention of Haitians with the great HIV scare in Guantanamo Bay after the refugees were created there, and with all of the mess between about 1988 and 94, Wesley Clark was associated with any number of severe human rights violations and military malpractices there. He was, of course, head of NATO command in Europe, and in charge, really, of the entire Serbia bombing campaign in Kosovo. And if you go back
which included dropping cluster bombs near heavily populated areas, as it has in Iraq.
Yeah, and on many, many civilian and infrastructure targets in gross violation of the Geneva Convention.
Including schools and churches and hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah, and water treatment plants and environmental catastrophes with chemical plants that in populated areas, and just
polluting rivers that provide the main water source for a number of cities and towns in that area.
Well, not just number of cities and towns in the area, but the Danube, which is the main waterway of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to counterpunch.org, which is Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair's fine website, and go back to 98, 99, that period leading up to and during during the bombing of Yugoslavia. And you can see some work that Coburn did at the time, in which he did some reporting on Clark himself that basically painted Clark as unhinged, as not just a war criminal, but somebody who was not just arrogant, but a megalomaniac, and really almost the way Coburn portrays him as mentally unstable.
Would the time period be 98, 99?
Yeah, that's what I said. I'm sorry.
I thought you said early 90s.
Well, I
89, 90.
It doesn't matter now.
Well, no, but yeah, 98, 99 was what I meant to say if I didn't. But go back and take a look at that, because the makeover and the way that many progressives are trying to repaint him now as this is a man of peace, this is a man of integrity, whatnot, is really kind of scary. It's like there's no yesterday in this country.
All right, quickly, we neglected to mention that Jim Compton apparently he's out of town now, apparently getting a new Teflon coating applied.
Yeah, and I wonder how he got the plane tickets to get out of town, too.
Yeah, yeah, Compton has been taking a little bit of heat, not a lot, for having accepted a plane ride down to a Portland Trail Blazers game and riding with a bunch of Paul Allen's crew on a Vulcan chartered airplane.
The Trailblazers being one of Paul Allen's teams.
Yes. Now, it turns out that the agreement he had signed and that the Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission was supposed to approve this week and did approve, that was supposed to be
slapping the other.
Supposed to be more than a slap on the wrist, is actually even less than a slap on a wrist. Compton had said that he would excuse himself from voting on any issues that came before the council in the next year related to the South Lake Union development. Well, it turns out that the agreement isn't quite that specific. He doesn't have to excuse himself from most votes on the South Lake Union development project. He only has to excuse himself from votes that are quasi-judicial matters, like rezoning private property or getting a variance for or vacations for alleys, that sort of things that involve land use matters. And those things aren't expected to come before the council in the next year. So major decisions like whether or not to fund a streetcar, he can still vote on those issues. And I'm assuming
whether
he's
to
probably,
accept a bucket load of cash from Vulcan, he can still vote on that.
He can still vote on all those issues, and I'm assuming he's going to.
Yeah, a very, very sleazy gentleman.
It was a very poorly written agreement.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. And Jav, you had a couple events to mention real quickly?
Yeah, several things, actually. We've got the very highly priced Molly Ivins Al Franken event tomorrow night, where there's a send-off for the busloads of immigrants going to Washington, D.C. They'll be at Seattle Center at 1:30 this afternoon. And then Eat the State, celebrating its 7th anniversary this week with a dynamite new website makeover, by the way. Thank you, Becky and Peter. And for that, we are having a fundraising dinner, a 2,000-cent a plate fundraising dinner that will be a week from tomorrow night, Sunday
that,
night.
That translates
29th.
Into $20
yes,
for folks 20, who can't do their math this
exactly.
early in the morning.
Yeah, it's and we're not having it at either the McCaw Opera House or the McCaw Family Residence. We are having it at the residence of Joe Swaya, the former Green Party candidate for Congress, and I believe he's a co-chair now for the Green Party, and a really fine gentleman, and Deb Morrison, his wonderful
his partner.
And a fine activist in her own right. That's in Ravenna. If you would like to RSVP for that, you can call the Eat the State voicemail, and we'll give that number again in a minute. It's area code 206-903-9461. And again, 2,000 cents, $20. That gets you dinner and hang out with Eat the State volunteers and political gurus of all types.
All right, real quickly, talking with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And what's the other contact info for Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in places where you find free periodicals. We're also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And our voicemail line again is 903-9461, area code 206.